Before I get to those questions, I want to touch on this last point of the Mueller investigation, which is obstruction of justice. Again, we're dealing with the circumstantial evidence situation. You've got, obviously, the president who, through a number of attacks, I think something like 1,100 tweets, has gone after the Mueller investigation. He asked Comey to back off of the investigation of Mike Flynn. He fired Comey and told NBC that it was because of the Russia investigation. He's considered pardons for his associates and family. The defense would argue that the Constitution gives the president sweeping power to hire and fire, to start and stop law enforcement proceedings, and grant presidential pardons. The argument seems to come down to, if the president is so brazen about his attacks on law enforcement, that it becomes difficult to prove a conspiracy or provide the corrupt intent for obstruction. Is that right?
Let me use an example to sort of illustrate why I don't think it's right. If the president wanted to make Maher the ambassador to France, that's certainly within certainly within his Article II executive authority. No problem, no question, right? But what if he did it in return for a $5 million cash bribe? I think people would be deeply troubled by that. You should be. That's a crime. And so I don't think the president, any president, has unfettered executive authority if the intent of his actions, and intent is what's so important here, is to obstruct a federal criminal investigation. Now, you don't have to succeed in obstructing it. Under the obstruction statute, the word is whoever endeavors. So if I tried to kill a witness and I failed, or I tried to intimidate a witness and that witness still testified against me, I'm still guilty of obstruction. So you don't have to succeed, you do have to intend, and I don't believe you can read Article 2 that broadly to permit corrupt obstructive acts to be outside the ambit of federal law.
And you know, just one thing from my reporting at the White House, there are many things that Donald Trump does where he knows what he's doing. In other words, when he repeatedly attacks Mueller, he has a goal in mind, a political goal. He wants to undermine his credibility. But in terms of the obstruction question, the way it's been explained to me is that Donald Trump really believes that he was merely defending himself. In other words, the guy came at me with a knife. I had to blow his head off. In other words, they were attacking me. I had to get rid of Comey. In other words, in his mind, he was just doing the thing that he needed to do to survive. Now, he might have, I don't know, that's not an excuse to not know the law, but that's what he thought.
Interesting.
Okay, let me turn to some of these questions. Oh, we live in interesting times.
That's the Chinese curse.
Yeah.
Isn't
it? Yeah.
Can a president, again, Constitution provides very broad powers of the ability of a president to pardon. And I think the word is except in the case of impeachment.
Correct.
Can a president of the United States pardon himself or herself?
So the answer, I think most constitutional scholars would give you is no. The president may not pardon himself or herself. That phrase, except in cases of impeachment, is intended to acknowledge that the only remedy to remove a president short of the 25th Amendment or the ballot box is impeachment. It would sort of turn the impeachment clause on its head if a president could pardon himself. I haven't seen any serious constitutional scholar say that. I've seen some people say that. I just haven't seen any serious constitutional scholar say that.
All right. We, the taxpayers, are paying for the Mueller investigation, and the law says we are not entitled to see it. Do the laws around this need to be changed? This is a special counsel's provision.
Well, the special counsel is only required to provide a confidential report to the Attorney General, who then has to brief Congress, but only on some things. So no, there is no requirement, unlike when we used to have the independent counsel law. Ken Starr, if you guys remember that, he was required to present a report. Okay, so we know from polling that something like 83% of Americans believe that if there is a Mueller report, it should be released in its entirety to the public for exactly the reason that that questioner, you know, read. So I think that if there is a report, there will be tremendous pressure to release it. Bill Barr can redact some of it. But you've even heard from people, prominent Republicans in the Senate, like John Cornyn and Chuck Grassley, who've both said the Mueller report will have to be made public.
One cautionary note. I hope it is. I'm looking forward to reading it, frankly. But the Jaworski report, filed with the Congress under seal, you know, 40-some-odd years ago, became public a few months ago.
The full report?
Full report became public a few months ago.
Did the Judiciary Committee not ask for a copy of that report?
I don't know the answer to that, Leon, but I do know that it was provided under seal pursuant to a court order because there was stuff in it, like grand jury information, that by law cannot be made public, and given to the Congress, who maintained it under seal remarkably for four decades.
Okay, what are the, Jim, this is for you, I think. What are the dangers of a president ignoring the advice of intelligence and military leaders? Let me just add to that. The president obviously has had a conflict with intelligence. I think you got the double meaning here. he's obviously questioned the assessments by the intelligence. And intelligence has come out with very different assessments on North Korea, Iran, ISIS, and he raised concerns about that. What are the dangers of a president who, rejects the information that intelligence is presenting? And what does the intelligence officials do in that situation?
Well, first of all, I think it needs to be said that the commander-in-chief, a policymaker, to include policymaker number one, always has the prerogative of accepting, rejecting, or ignoring the intelligence that is teed up to him or her. And President Trump has that prerogative. I would offer, though, that doing so on a repetitive, routine basis over a long period of time on multiple issues is pretty dangerous. Dangerous for the country and dangerous for his presidency. We've been pretty fortunate, and we really haven't had, God forbid, an event of the magnitude of a 9/11, or God forbid, a serious nuclear confrontation with Russia, for example, just to name two. And if we did, the president will need the assessments, the facts, the evidence that only the intelligence community can give him. And his gut won't be enough. So again, I think over time, it's his prerogative, but over time, it's not good. The other thing about this is there should be, and under ideal circumstances, a bond of trust between the president and his or her intelligence community. And that bond of trust needs to work both ways. And when there is distrust and suspicion, and when the president is given to personal attacks, personal assaults on the people who are trying to serve him, that is not good.
Go ahead, Chuck. For you, Jim, and for you, Leon, isn't it also, though, that the president's rejection of the intelligence has been public rejection? I'm sure you've both briefed presidents who've questioned intelligence, but they didn't do it publicly, or did they, and did I miss
it? No, I think that's the difference. I mean, look, I suspect that there are a lot of presidents who questioned some of the intelligence that they got. And some of it, as we presented the intelligence briefings, the president would say, well, wait a minute, I don't really believe that there's a good source of information here. Go back and check it. Or he would ask, you know, is this really the case? So he would question. Most presidents question that information. But they do it within the confines of the Oval Office. They don't do it on Twitter.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. You know, it really is disconcerting to have it go public when he objects to that kind of information because, you know, the intelligence officials are presenting the best information they had. Look, the PDB, and Jim can agree with this, the PDB, which is the Presidential Daily Bulletin, we all got it in the morning. And it, when I was at the CIA, I obviously got it when I was just driving in. You read that damn thing, and it's pretty depressing because it's about all of the threats in the world that are aimed at the United States. And look, some are serious, some are not. But the duty of a president is to look at all of that because that's all about potential threats to this country. And if you ignore it, if you don't want to pay attention to it, that's dangerous. Intelligence is important for military leaders, and it's important for the president of the United States.
You know, it's actually a very healthy thing when a president or anyone who's receiving intelligence is skeptical, or questions it, or wants more confirmation or affirmation of what you're trying to tell them. That's fine, but there's a big difference between skepticism and disparagement.
Mara, this is down your line. What are some of the long-term effects of the administration's attacks on the news media?
Well, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. But I don't know what the long-term effects will be because it depends on, is he the president for 2 years, another 2 years, six? Don't forget, there are so many other pressures on the news media that kind of amplify the attacks that Trump makes about fake news, enemies of the people, et cetera. The whole idea of fake news, there was real fake news out there. Some of it was manufactured by the Russians. The danger of fake news or propaganda or disinformation is not just that people will believe it, but that then they won't believe news that is fact-based and reality-based. And it's not just the president, although to have the most powerful man on the planet constantly trying to undermine the press is really scary. It's bad for democracy. But the business model of social media also increases polarization, destroys trust in institutions. I mean, if we are becoming a very low trust society, which means people don't trust our basic institutions, they don't believe what they read in the press, what do they believe? They believe what comes into their Facebook friends, or whatever it's called, friends group news feed, and that's where people find out all of this information like Obama is a Muslim and vaccines cause autism. So that's, you know, the problem, the business model of social media, which is to keep you online longer so they can sell more ads, which means feeding you more extreme content because that's what they've found through their algorithms will keep people on longer. That destroys trust and makes it hard to have a kind of fact-based system. So all of these things are really scary to me. I mean, like I said before, I operate in the small, unfortunately getting smaller realm of mainstream news organizations that try to be reality-based and fact-based. But if we're not a society that starts with facts and works our way to opinions as opposed to the other way around, where too much now we start with opinions and then backfill a few convenient facts we found somewhere, we can't have a useful discussion or a debate about anything. So that really worries me. I think that there will not be another president exactly like Donald Trump in terms of his their disrespect for democratic institutions, including the press. I'm not saying we're going to go back to the way things were. We don't just have Walter Cronkite and two networks. I mean, the difficulties of the press have been well chronicled, and they started long before Donald Trump. Too many people consume media for affirmation, not information. They're just going to listen to some news organization that already agrees with them. And the news media is incredibly polarized, and that happened before Donald Trump. You know, the joke is Fox and MSNBC don't even cover the same natural disasters. But so those things are the genies that can't be put back in the bottle. But I believe that the next president will not only not make those attacks, they will go out of their way to reaffirm their commitment to basic democratic principles, including the First Amendment. That's my hopeful prediction about the future.
Chuck, let me ask you this. Jeff, I think it's important to look at the role of the Justice Department, the role of the AG. Jeff Sessions obviously recused himself, I think properly.
Properly so, I agree.
Suffered for it.
And the president criticized him for recusing himself because he wanted an attorney general that would protect him on that issue. When you look at the role of the attorney general, I mean, you know, John Kenney appointed his brother, Bobby Kennedy, as attorney general. And Eric Holder obviously was attorney general for President Obama. Where is that line between enforcing the law and loyalty to the president?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question, Leon. So let me answer it in two ways. I mean, we all recognize that the president gets to pick his cabinet, and part of the cabinet is the attorney general. And so there's the attorney general role as policymaker. The president wants to impose certain policies, and some of them involve, let's say, you know, prison reentry or rehabilitation or sentencing reform. That's an appropriate policy role for the attorney general. But attorneys general, by the way, that is the plural, it's attorneys general, have to be really careful when they have their law enforcement hat on, because that has to be, as Jim Comey would say, an other in American life. That cannot be part of the executive branch. Here's the way I think about it. When I was at the FBI, and I had the privilege of serving there on two occasions, there are 37,000 men and women, agents, analysts, forensic scientists, professional support in the FBI. Do you know how many of them are politically appointed? One. One. The director. That's it. Nobody else. And when I had the privilege of serving as the United States Attorney in Eastern Virginia, though I had been a line prosecutor in that office and a career civil servant, when I was in that role, I was the only political appointee. The political layer in the enforcement components of the Department of Justice are by design extraordinarily thin. So if you're talking about AG as policymaker, fine. But if you're talking about AG as law enforcer, you have to maintain that independence. And that's how we are brought up in the Department of Justice. We don't talk about politics. We don't think about politics. We try hard as hell to not be human beings and discuss politics like other human beings do. And so I think of it in those two separate ways. I hope it makes some sense.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, when James Comey did what he did with regards to the Hillary investigation, do you think he made a mistake in not following the standards?
So I'm biased because Jim is my friend. And I think Jim does an extraordinary job of, I'll answer your question. I think Jim does an extraordinary job of explaining his rationale in his book, that it was almost quite literally a unique situation in which there was an open investigation of a major party candidate for president, and that if he did not put it to rest, it would have been leaked or he would have been accused of covering up the fact that there was an investigation. His rationale makes sense. On the other hand, it has always been the policy of the department not to talk about cases we don't bring. I know that's a double negative, but it's appropriate here. We don't talk about things we don't bring. We talk about cases we do bring, and we talk about them in court. And you almost can never go wrong falling back on policy. So I understand Jim's argument. He's an incredibly thoughtful guy, of why he thought this one was different. And frankly, in July, when he announced that he was going to recommend against charging Hillary Clinton, people were not as upset as they were later in October and November when he announced that he had reopened and then closed the case. I think the rationale for that is different. But I think if there is a fault, and I tell you, Jim is a dear friend of mine, it's in that he thought that there needed to be an exception to our policy. I don't make any money off his book, but read it, because he has an extraordinarily compelling rationale for what he did. You may disagree with it.
So wait, you're sympathetic to what he did in July, but not in October?
No, actually the opposite. In October and November, he had told Congress when he testified there that if things changed, he would tell them.
That's right.
And then things changed, and then he told them. So I think in October and November, he was in a box. There's more nuance to it than that. But I understand why he did what he did. And like I said, I think he's an incredibly thoughtful guy. None of it was political, but he strayed from our policy.
Let me ask you something. Accepting the rationale that he presented, the concern I have is and it's always a danger when FBI directors try to touch political issues. But having done what he did with Hillary Clinton, when the FBI found out that the Russians were interfering with our election process and that there was some contacts with the Trump campaign, why did he not think that that was worth revealing to the public?
I think there's a simple, but I hope not simplistic, answer to that question. From Jim's perspective, the Clinton investigation was over and he was announcing his recommendation. The Russia investigation was ongoing. It's another policy of the department, with a very rare exception, that you don't talk about ongoing investigations. And so that strikes me as a fair distinction between the two. Some people don't like that, and I get it, because they see the two as equivalents. But a closed investigation and an open investigation, in my mind, are different animals.
Jim, you went to North Korea. The president is going to North Korea as we speak.
He's going to Vietnam, I think.
You're right. Yeah. You're not going to North Korea.
Maybe it would be a good thing.
If he was going to North Korea, we'd be really concerned about whether we have to pay to get him released. So he's going to Vietnam. And he's going to meet with Kim Jong-un. He had the initial meeting in Singapore, and although there was some peripheral benefits to that, we really didn't get any steps towards denuclearization. So he's going to meet in Vietnam now. And I guess my question to you, based on your knowledge of the North Koreans, is whether or not he's going to be able to get them to take verifiable steps to denuclearize?
I doubt it. I supported the idea of President Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore in June. When I was there, and I had quite a bit of dialogue with senior North Koreans, and I was struck by how stuck they are on their narrative, and how stuck we were on our narrative. You know, my first White House issued talking point that I was supposed to recite to the North Koreans when I went in November 14 was, "You must denuclearize before we'll talk to you." Well, I was there about 5 minutes, and I understood right away that was lost cause. They were not going to denuclearize, and why should they? From their vantage, it is their ticket to survival. They brought up Muammar Gaddafi with me, and he negotiated away his weapons of mass destruction, and look how it turned out for him. and they realize their weaknesses, particularly militarily in relation to the Republic of Korea. They understand the economic straits they're in, and they also understand that no one would pay any attention to North Korea if it weren't for the nuclear capability. I would offer that the reason for their temperate behavior of late has not much to do with anything we've done or said or any of the tweets. It has much more to do with the fact that the North Koreans have achieved whatever it is they think they need for nuclear deterrence. Now, that may not be the way we'd grade it or evaluate it, but in their mind, they've achieved nuclear deterrence. So for the first time ever, they can come to the negotiating table not as a supplicant, which they've always been in the past. So anyway, I supported it. I thought the president squandered the huge leverage he had just by virtue of agreeing to meet, which is something the North Koreans have lusted for the whole existence of the DPRK. That's their name, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Kim Il-sung did, Kim Jong-il did, and now the grandson, Kim Jong-un. And that is a big deal to them, just having a direct meeting as co-equals. The question that I wish President Trump had asked Kim Jong-un the first meeting, and maybe now it'll be a do-over, is to ask him, what is it would take to make you feel sufficiently secure that you don't need nuclear weapons? Now, we might not like the answer to that, but it seems to me, if we're going to design a negotiating strategy, it'd be useful to know that. And right now, we don't. So I don't hold out much hope. It's a good thing that we're not having missile tests and underground explosions and all that. But I think it has less to do with what we're doing and much more to do with what the North Koreans think they've achieved. And I think, you know, they're not going to be in my lifetime when they'll denuclearize.
Yeah. Chuck, credibility of the FBI. You're a longtime member of the FBI. It's had a series of problems over these last number of months. The IG obviously criticized Comey on the way he handled the Clinton emails. He determined that McCabe lied, that some agents had political biases, that the FBI retaliated against whistleblowers, that they missed opportunities to prevent mass shootings. Obviously, they've been impacted. If you read the New York Times today, they're having a hard time on recruitment. My question is, what's going on? How bad is the situation, and can the damage be repaired?
Like all human institutions, they're fallible. I've never been in a place where I see people working harder to try and get it right, but sometimes, you know, people fail. And you know, I'm sure the list is actually longer than that, Leon. What pains me is that we don't talk about their list of successes, not just attacks that are prevented, but children that are recovered and you know, frauds that are unearthed. They have a remarkable list of successes too. That said, I understand that's not as interesting. I get that. I regret that, but I get that. Here's where it really hurts. When the riots in Ferguson took place, the police department in that city was not trusted by the people who lived there to figure out what happened. And so the FBI went in force and knocked on doors, and I believe in every instance, citizens who are very, very, very angry at the Ferguson PD talk to the FBI. For us to succeed, we need people to trust that the FBI really is that other in American life. We don't just have to be fair, we also have to be perceived as fair. And so when you reference those text messages between two FBI employees, what people lost in the IG report was this finding, that there was no evidence that the political biases expressed in those text messages, or frankly anywhere in the FBI, influenced the outcome of their work. People don't remember that part of it. People remember that a couple of employees exchanged highly inappropriate text messages. And so there's the need to be fair and the need to be perceived as fair. And that's what I think worries me right now. And if recruiting takes a hit, you know, that's a problem. If the FBI can't knock on doors and get honest answers to important questions, that's a problem. If they stop being that other in American life, that's a problem. So am I worried? Not dramatically so. Can it be repaired? Absolutely, but it's hard, and these are all setbacks, and they ought to concern all of us.
Jim, we're in the last few minutes here. I wanted you to tell the story about your failure to...
Which one?
Your failure to get good intelligence.
Yeah.
When you appeared at an event at the CIA?
Well, the event that Leon's talking about is when he was leaving CIA to go be Secretary of Defense. So I was one of a number of speakers that came to pay homage to Leon as he was leaving. And they had a big tent, circus tent, set up in the front yard of the CIA. So when I got up, I don't know, I was sixth or seventh speaker. And I thought, well, just to get a rise out of the crowd, I say, you know, I'm reminded of the apocryphal line ascribed to Elizabeth Taylor's eighth husband when he said, I know what I'm supposed to do, but how do I make it different? So, think about it. Yeah. So it got the desired effect, and so we're all done and we're trooping off the stage and Tish Long, who was then the director of NGA, the first, by the way, the first woman ever to be a director of a major intelligence agency. And Tish came up to me and she says, hey, guess who's here? My heart sank. In attendance was Senator John Warner.
Uh-oh. Well, it must be his husband, yeah.
And Senator Warner, he sponsored me for when I was Under Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, you know, a lion of the Senate, you know, this icon and all this, and my heart sank. So I'm looking around this huge crowd that turned out to honor Leon, and he was nowhere in sight. So I ran out to the tent, and I'm looking for my protective detail, and pick me up, take me back to the office. And there standing, John Warner. Well, I ran over to him and almost literally fell on my knees and, oh, Senator Warner, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I was just trying to get a laugh. I hope it didn't offend you. And he just said, no, it was a great story, great line. By the way, I was number six. So, I mean, know your audience, department. Yeah.
That's such a great story.
That's when Intel failed me.
Really. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of this program. Again, I really do want to stress the importance of we the people. That's the beginning of, those are the words that begin the Constitution, we the people. And I think ultimately it really is up to we the people to be the ultimate check and balance. We have a lot of institutions. I think some of those institutions are performing well. Some are not performing so well. But the reality is that in the end, it really is we the people who make the final decisions with regards to whether or not our democracy will survive. I think what this program has shown, with the benefit of our speakers, is that we're dealing with a number of tough issues. This is a difficult time, let's not kid anybody, in terms of the politics in Washington, plus the dangers we're facing in the world. And the most important thing we can do is to have these discussions, debate with one another, and ultimately agree that we have to come together in order to make sure that our democracy is secure for the future. Thank you very much.